Addison, let me describe a neighborhood to you. It's a place where you can go to work, you can shop, you can send your kids to school, you can go to the doctor or the dentist, and you can go to the park. And all of this is within a 15-minute walk or bike ride or maybe a public transit ride, be it bus or subway. What's wrong with this?
Well, absolutely nothing is wrong with that. In fact, I've heard of that before. I would just call that a neighborhood. I would like to think that most people, if you put it that way, would also call it a neighborhood and would also intuitively understand exactly what you're describing.
Welcome to Journey with Purpose, episode 33. I'm your host, Randy Plummel. If we haven't met before, I'm a former architect, now owner of a small but mighty design firm called Expedition Works, where we help the public sector engage with residents in a meaningful way. Because an expedition is just a journey with purpose. Now, you might have heard the term 15-minute city before, especially if you're interested in cities or urbanism. We've been working on a series of interviews about it, about the good and the bad, and then this happened.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. Last year, there were demonstrations happening in countries around the world protesting against an urban planning concept called the 15-minute city.
Yes, that's the amazing 99% Invisible. They dropped a 15-minute city episode last week in their feed, right when we were editing this episode. There's probably a word in German for when someone drops a story right before you are going to drop yours. So I can either be really frustrated or really the way I'm thinking about it right now, it's actually really freeing. So we can get rid of all the stuff around explaining what a 15-minute city is, and you can go and listen to their episode. It's in the show notes. It's right below. And they even have some snippets of interview with the researcher and the person who coined the term 15-minute city, Carlos Moreno. So go over to 99pi.com and listen to the episode. It's in the show notes and then come back here. I'll wait. Okay, you're back. Wasn't that great? That was a great 42 minutes. Had some of the background and some of the tension between the concept and some of the people who were critiquing it. But today, we speak with writer Addison Del Mastro, who has a critique of Carlos Moreno's book, The 15-Minute City. Now, this isn't a critique that coming from a place of either bad faith or not wanting it. This is coming from a place of love and really wanting 15-minute neighborhoods, proximate cities, walkable neighborhoods, whatever you want to call it, to happen. It's about creating urbanism that we used to have, we have in some places, and that we can make more places like it. So here's our episode with Addison. Can you tell us your name, what you do, and where we're speaking to you from?
My name is Addison Del Mastro. I'm a former magazine editor, and now I'm a full-time freelance writer. I write about urbanism and urban design and land use and all that good stuff. And I am recording from a car, which is a great mobile studio in Northern Virginia.
And so you had this great article in the Bulwark, which we'll link to, called Who's Afraid of the 15-Minute City? So who is afraid of this description I just gave of the 15-Minute City? And what is the nut of the problem of the 15-Minute City from your point of view?
That's sort of the meta question, because what I like to think is that no one is really afraid of what the 15-Minute City is, which I take to be what you just described, but for a lot of reasons, this idea has gotten caught up in all kinds of lurid stuff, some of which is really wacky conspiracy theory stuff, some of which is anti-elitism. It's a review of the book called The 15-Minute City by the planner Carlos Moreno, who actually sort of came up with the 15-Minute City. So I figured, of course, I had heard this crazy stuff about how the 15-Minute City is this authoritarian scheme to restrict mobility and not let people leave their 15-minute zone or whatever. And I said, well, this is the official book about it, so it must put all that nonsense to bed, right? And I read the book, and I was just ever so slightly less sure that this was just a book about building traditional towns and cities, because there's a lot of academic words in it. Words. I felt like I was in college again reading an essay and asking my classmates, hey, what the hell does this mean? You know, and it's this interplay of elitism and academic writing and this reticence among certain sorts of highly educated people, frankly, to speak plainly. And then that interacts with this sort of right-wing media industrial complex and the podcasters and the Fox News and all that stuff. And they'll sort of play telephone with this turgid academic writing. And you've got a lot of normal people who lean to the right and who watch that media, and they never even think about urbanism. And so literally the only thing they ever may have heard about this concept is weird academic writing getting filtered through right-wing influences. And I'm here just, guys, it's just a town, it's just a city, you know what this is, it's not scary. But the way that we talk about it, that just gets lost. The actual meaning gets lost.
I think there's definitely some criticisms that are clearly in bad faith. I'm thinking like Jordan Peterson, there's people who they are taking this as a fodder and what I would think of this sort of outrage fire. And then the strain of some of the criticisms that came out of the original Tea Party movement 15 years ago that were against, say, Agenda 21 and some of that UN organizational things around, hey, can we build some more sustainable cities? They were really against that. So how do we deal with something that if we pull aside some of the academic ease and look at it versus it's caught up in this sort of maelstrom of outrage. Is this really Moreno's remit to be a better pundit or a standard bearer? Or is this just he needs a better editor? What do you think would make this better so that you and I aren't having this conversation about like, what does he even mean when he means 15-minute cities?
Yeah, look, I don't want to be too negative on Moreno. And I say in the review, the book is difficult to get there, but at the end is that's okay, but you also need translators. You need people who can take that and make it sound like it's referring to a real thing that we've actually seen before. It's interesting you bring up the UN and the Agenda 21. I've obviously heard that stuff. I heard that stuff when I was a kid, even. And I read a comment once that I thought was interesting about that. And the guy said, you know, people ride bikes, and so you might put in a bike lane and you might argue over how much space goes to cars and how much space goes to bikes, and it's just a little local thing. And then the UN puts bike lanes in Agenda 21, and suddenly bike lanes are a communist plot. And so some people, when I write this sort of thing, take me to be blaming the experts and saying we have to accommodate the crazy conspiracy theorists. And I'm not saying that. I guess what I'm saying is that urbanism isn't a partisan issue, isn't a political issue. We all live somewhere. When we say the built environment, which maybe even that sounds like a bit of jargon to some people, it just means you live somewhere and your life takes place in the context that you live it in. And that context should be conducive to doing things that we need to do. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean when I say urbanism. And I do personally lean to the right. I'm not trying to turn people into progressives when I try to get them to be more favorable to urbanism. I'm just trying to talk about how much it matters that the places we live in are functional for all of the things that we need. I think American individualism biases us against thinking of things in that way to some extent. There is a little bit of an element of like you have to think collectively or in a communitarian way to fully get this, but not in an ideological way, certainly not in a communist way or whatever. Just like look at Main Street, look at an American small town. It's a place we built together and live in together. And most of what we build today doesn't look like that, and it could look more like that. And Moreno can write whatever he wants, but I think you also need people saying what I just said.
I'm pretty liberal, but my biggest small c conservative belief is that there was a lot of great empirical knowledge about how we lived, and that was gathered from centuries, which was tossed out on the wayside for a variety of reasons, starting probably in the 20s and moving definitely post-war. And that while I'm not a proponent of let's fully return to the past, I think there's a value to being upfront about learning from our elders. And I think this is what I'm hearing from you is that Moreno and perhaps say new urbanists. It's like, why can't you just say we got it right for a long time? We can just turn the clock back a little bit, and not that we have to turn it all the way back. We can sort of pick and choose because we're present day people. Is that fair to say, or is there a complicating factor there?
No, I think that's very fair. And yeah, obviously turning back the clock to some extent on how we build streets or how we plat towns or whatever, that doesn't imply turning back the clock on racial equality or other things. There's a certain bias against just saying, yeah, we got it right and we should go back. There's always this tendency to want to make your mark on an idea. There's this sort of really basic definitional tension where one sentence will be, this is a revolutionary new idea for how to inhabit our cities. And then the next sentence will be returning to old wisdom. And which is it? And I understand exactly what they're saying. I get it. I get that in many ways this is traditional urbanism, but also introducing something traditional in a society that has forgotten it is in some ways revolutionary. But it just strikes me as almost a kind of hubris that we're really just reinventing the wheel here and we don't want to say that, or we have to pretend it's something new. And that does lead to some of this suspicion, because this is really just building cities like we used to build them. Why are there all these words? Why is there a whole book about it? There must be more to it. And then probing what that more is, that's the crack. That's the little crack in the door that the crazy people drive a truck through, and that a lot of normal people who consume that media just sort of pick up by osmosis.
I live in Queens, New York. I just walked my kids to school. It's a 10-minute walk. I can go to Rockefeller Center. It's literally a 10-minute subway ride. And so that's a version. I think it's really easy to hear 15 minutes city walkable, and all of a sudden you see big skyscrapers and you see that, which it doesn't need to be that way. My in-laws in the Midwest, they essentially live in about a 20-minute city where they can walk to the library, they can bike to it, things like that. And I wonder, to your point, is you can talk about it at an abstract level, or you can talk at a very tactical level. But the problem is that there's a big gulf in between. And so it allows people to fill it in with their biggest fears, be it traffic, be it the fear of the other, or the fear of the unknown. And the fear of the unknown is perfectly, I think, legitimate, because we all worry about what the future will be like across the political spectrum. And so I wonder if, in this case, it's less helpful to point out what a 15-minute city is at like a strategic level, and it might be easier at a tactical level. Like you said earlier, you're not an expert in this, but you've read some of this and you're coming at it slightly with normie eyes that you could help us either make this argument better or to make the policies better.
Yeah, what that brings to mind for me is this point I always make about small towns, right? Everyone in America pretty much loves small towns and loves Main Street, and that's like your quintessential image of America. Not the only one, but one of them. One of the mom, apple pie, maybe New York City and Main Street. Not everyone loves New York. I do. I grew up in New Jersey. So I love the big city and the small town. I grew up in a small town. What I started to realize as I got interested in urbanism as a lay person was these American small towns are absolutely everywhere, and most of them are over 100 years old at this point, or quite a bit more than that. Some of the oldest American cities, of course, predate the Revolution. I was just in Old Town Alexandria last weekend, founded, I think, in the 1750s. And these are places now that today are mostly, call them historic districts. We think of them as quaint. You go there to stroll and you get ice cream and you go to the boutiques. And at some point along the way, it struck me that these were not always historic districts. There wasn't always this idea of the quaint small town and the classic Main Street. These are places that were actually dynamic and in the process of being built and torn down and becoming what they are now. And people actually lived there and did business there. And there were my little hometown, which is 5,000 people, used to have a department store and two supermarkets in the 1900s. And now it's just lawyers' offices and boutiques and whatnot. So just that realization that people actually lived in these places and we actually lived in this way. We didn't always have cars. We didn't always have suburbia. And I kind of went my whole life growing up in small town America, and it never really clicked for me that these were actual places that people lived. I just always experienced them as lifestyle amenities for suburbanites. And that was just such a striking thing to realize that obviously we were rural and agricultural country, but we were also really a properly urban country. And that, like you alluded to a few minutes ago, there was something quite revolutionary about throwing all of that out and adopting the car and adopting suburbia. And there are reasons we did that, and there are good things about that. You don't have to look to academia. You don't have to look to Europe. You just have to look to our own history and some of the finest places we ever built to mostly see what we urbanists want today. And that's the long pitch that I give somebody who doesn't trust this stuff or who thinks it's big government or who thinks I want to make us Amsterdam or whatever. You can stay within this country's heritage and you can discover within that everything you need to do urbanism well.
I think that's right. My personal opinion and my policy proposals would be to make America look like Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, or perhaps like Georgetown, or perhaps like parts of Boston. But I realize that not everybody wants to live that way. I'd like to say a statement. I'd love for you to challenge it, amend it, or confirm it. So when I hear, oh, big government will make me live one way, part of me says, we already do that. Most of America is zoned for single-family detached homes. And most of the places that we think, like Alexandria or Georgetown, those sort of 3-4-story buildings with a shop on the ground floor or office space are effectively illegal in most of America. We already live in a one-size-fits-all government-organized space that we don't have to live that way. There's nothing unique or there's no natural law saying a single family detached home is the only way to live. And I grew up in one. Like, I had lots of fun and it was a really great childhood. But I wonder, do we have it backwards? Are we actually in that one size fits all government organized land? And how do we start shifting that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I obviously think about that. I've had this argument with people. I think that's true, that we do live in a world in terms of land use that is much more tightly regulated than it was 100 or 150 years ago. I always give the example of reading about an old railroad. We actually had more railroad stops in this region 100 years ago than we have now, I believe, or covering more land. And you'll read about these railroads, and it's like they wanted to build a spur to some new town, and they built it, and 6 months later, the station opened, and now the lawsuits go on for 10 years. So there is absolutely this ability to just get up and do things and build things that we've lost because of, and I would call it overregulation, and some people might call it or frame it something different. So I agree with that statement of fact. But you can look at it as an intellectual question that, like, if we can just convince people that we're actually living under the thumb of big government right now, then they'll become urbanists. And there are some people who really think twice when they realize this, because we do live in a historically revolutionary land use regime compared to the rest of our history. And yet it's true. At the same time, most people don't experience it that way. It feels utterly normal. We like the guarantee of order and stability. And there are real interests involved there. And some of them are property values and some of them are not nice, racism and classism. And some of them are just, I like what I like and I want it to stay that way. And those are concrete interests that are not based in opinions about the free market or property rights, I don't think. So that's actually the tougher thing for urbanists to make a case for why at least some change is good and okay. And it's not that we want to come for your neighborhoods or determine how you live. It's just that your interests are legitimate, but also when everyone has those interests, you lose the ability for places to organically grow and develop, and you end up with a nationwide housing crisis. It's all a mix of understanding these intellectual arguments and making them in a way that people can look differently at things, but also understanding there are real concrete reasons why people like the status quo, regardless of how they might argue themselves intellectually to get there. And to some extent, we have to make peace with those and to some extent push back on them. And that's where the hard conversations happen.
Yeah, you're right. Because I think intellectually, a lot of these arguments are not internally consistent. And that's they're from people. And people aren't internally consistent because they're people. They work across purposes. And you see this in New York, where right now there's a slight changes called City of Yes that is trying to work its way through, which the idea is to add a little bit more housing everywhere. And part of that is getting rid of parking mandates. And part of that is allowing ADUs. And part of that is allowing 4 and 5 story walk-ups. And it has been about 6 to 12 months of yelling from a lot of people who are afraid that their lifestyle is going to change. I have sympathy for the unknown. I have less sympathy for some of the policymakers who I believe should know better, but maybe they don't. And maybe that's my assumption that is wrong. I wonder if part of the problem is it's really easy to be fearful of the future. And part of the reason there's a suspect of government intrusion into the city, some of that, the bad acts that were done in the 50s and 60s and the early 70s around the urban policy and things like that. And so I wonder, from your point of view, as a layperson who has seen this, do you have any suggestions about how we can get people to consider the future that isn't just the fear side, the downside risk, and help them get in a position to at least consider that things like a little bit more housing means a little bit more tax base, which means a little less taxes you have to pay. It means more kids for your kids to play with at the playground. How do we set the stage where we can see not just the glass half empty, but perhaps a wider range of futures?
The really big level point is that land use is an independent variable in everything. It matters. You know, you see this when there's a new shopping center going up or there's a vacancy and people say, oh, they should put a bookstore there. Or like, who should put a bookstore there? That bookstores don't just materialize. You need the people to patronize them. You need the businesses to feel like it'll pencil out. I think we tend to see the amenities of a place as totally disconnected from the people who live there. Like when we hear density, all we imagine is tall buildings packed full of people and traffic jams. But we don't imagine parks bustling with people and new businesses opening. I don't know why that is. I think we just don't really think about land use much at all. We're not accustomed to thinking of people except in terms of getting in our way. And frankly, doing everything in a car intensifies that because it doesn't take that many people to cause a traffic jam. It takes a lot more people to jam up a sidewalk than to jam up a 6-lane road. And so you have this irony of places that are really quite empty, but they feel overcrowded. And you have people saying, we're filling up, we're full, no more people. And it's like, well, you barely started. And I think part of what has to happen, I would love to see one mayor of one city just, and I know a couple of cities have done a good job of this, and I know the mayor also can't just do this. Theoretically, I would love to see one big city just push through all of the big urbanist reforms and say, look, we'll put back the status quo in 5 years if it doesn't work, but we're just going to see what happens. I don't think we've test-driven it, to put it that way, enough stuff in enough places that it starts to feel real. It still feels untested. And to a great extent, in much of America, it is untested. I'd like to think a lot of this tension would evaporate if we could just point to a few places and say, look, this is what this actually means. Not just legacy cities that were like this 100 years ago, but places that have done these reforms and have turned out okay, beyond the handful that have done that. And that's what American suburbanites need when it comes to cities, like show, don't tell. We need a lot more of that. But to have more of that, you need to actually get the thing done. And so it becomes a little chicken and egg. But show, don't tell is really important here.
I like your point about how can we show people? And then I instantly think, well, people go to Disney World, at Disneyland. That's walkable urbanism, but they're not city-pilled coming out of it. So there's some sort of disconnect there. And I think that tension is interesting to me as both a design professional, but also as someone who wants to make sure that we engage with the residents and make sure that their hopes, dreams, fears are listened to and actually are helped solved.
There's always shop talk. People can use that within the profession. That's fine. There's always shorthand. But at the end of the day, it just has to be relatable to people. And thinking about the question of demonstrating, showing, it actually occurs to me that one of the issues could possibly be that once a reform works, it just feels normal. And so it almost ceases to be a demonstration in a way, because it's like how I can walk around some neighborhoods in the older suburbs here around D.C. And you can point to houses and you can be like, that's actually a duplex and it looks like a single family and you didn't even know mm-hmm. that. And the reaction is, yeah, but that works mm-hmm. here. It didn't work here until it was allowed here. But once something works, it just almost becomes part of the status quo. And it becomes hard to say, this was a newfangled thing 5 years ago and look how normal it is. Because no one wants to be the one to experience it when it's newfangled. Mm-hmm. If the reform actually works, it's almost harder to point to it as a particular idea, and it just becomes part of the scenery yep. in a way.
We see this in New York. There were political opponents to City Bike that was like, this is going to kill people. The city is over. It was implemented under Bloomberg. We're now, what, two mayors after that? And it's just part of the city. The pedestrianization of Times Square, there is a lot of gnashing of teeth with that. And now, you know, it's still kind of not a place I like to go to, but at least I'm not going to get hit by a car walking around it in the plaza area. So I think that's a really good point that things drift into what I call the always was. Well, this was new at some point, yep. but now it always is.
I saw on social media, someone pointed out one of these mixed-use developments in a very NIMBY town. I think it was in Oregon. And he said these people protested the thing like mad. And then once it got built, they strolled around and they got their ice cream and it was like it was always there. And my headline was, if you build it, they won't care. And I basically said, you just need to get over that hump of this is a new proposal and it's going to replace blah, 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 and it's going to disrupt this or that. All of that just disappears once it's there. You know, my hometown had a decade that we argued over a redevelopment proposal for a historic hotel, and that thing's finally getting built. And they argued over how many floors it's going to be and how many parking spots it's going to be. Once it's built and the restaurant with a bar underneath opens and the hotel is running, no one's going to remember, oh, I'm glad this garage is 200 spots instead of 175 spots. It just all goes away once the thing gets done. And I hope there are people out there who, sometimes I feel like I'm almost doing therapy when I write about urbanism, because it's like, it's very human to fear this mm-hmm. stuff. But it's also an opportunity to identify these tendencies in yourself. Like, right now, I really do care how many spots there are going to be, but I can also look ahead and know that I'll forget about that when the thing is done. And I hope there are people who can actually become more self-aware and realize doing urbanism in America tests a lot of our human tendencies, but you know what? It'll all be okay. And it's okay to be afraid, but it's also okay to let the thing happen.
Well, that's a great place to end. Addison, where can we find you and your work?
My name is Addison Del Mastro. I live in Northern Virginia, where I'm recording this episode, outside Washington, D.C. I write a daily Substack newsletter called The Deleted Scenes, and I write for an assortment of magazines, especially The Bulwark, where I had this review. Check out my newsletter. I write every day but Sunday.
Many thanks to Addison for his time. It's interesting that two people from different parts of the political spectrum want the same thing. We want safe, walkable, accessible, equitable, and free neighborhoods so that we can go about our life. That if we don't want a car or don't want to use a car or we want to walk or bike, we can't. So my hunch is that the term 15-minute city is very much like the term new urbanism. It came about as a synthesis of a bunch of different themes and policies into this crystallized name of an idea that is an umbrella for a bunch of different tactics and ways of experiencing the world. So I think the 15-minute city had the misfortune to gain traction around the time when a global pandemic came along and then scrambled all of our lives. And I think some of the PTSD that we're dealing with has fallen onto the term 15-minute city. And I think the term 15-minute city got folded into a few other strands that were either happening at the time or were adjacent. Things like the smart city, which tried and claimed to try to use information technologies to, quote, make the city more connected and better, whatever that means. There was definitely a change in transportation design where cars weren't considered the primary only ways of getting around a neighborhood. So you get people thinking that different mobility tactics such as diverters, one-way streets, or different ways to calm traffic would limit people's ability to travel about as you pleased. I think the focus on biking and walking infrastructure in places like Paris, the Nordic countries, and even Carmel, Indiana, of all places, those interventions, if you have a zero-sum world of the street or mobility, could start to get concerned. And then also think the continued resurgence of urban living and the rise of the cost of housing in really desirable neighborhoods throughout the states came about and got folded into the 15-minute city. And then I also think that bad faith actors really wanted to fill the outrage machine. It's really easy for us to look at something, and when someone says it's new and different, to be wondering what that is and fearful. I think I'm more comfortable going back and saying, you know what? These are things that we already had. And it's something that we can just make a little bit of change to increase our net freedom to move about the city and live our lives. And I do think the term 15-minute city is the double-edged sword. It's a great shorthand to explain that we want to build neighborhoods where you can get everything within a short amount of time on foot or bike, but if you need to use a car or mobility device, you can. But it also allows people to project their fears onto a term. So it's a bit of a mirror to ourselves or our views or the future. So while we can't and shouldn't allow bad faith actors to own the phrase, it's really up to us to explain it in a clearer fashion and help people imagine into that future in an easier way where they're not just seeing the downsides, they're seeing a possible upsides around us. Where Moreno's argument gets into trouble, I believe, is wanting to, quote, propose a different way of life based on a polycentric proximity and changes in habits that alter the way we move around. That's from page 137. Behavior change is really, really difficult. It only really happens when you have major life events. You move to a new city, your family makeup changes, you have kids, people die, you lose a job, you get a job. Those are the places where behavior change can happen. And so Carlos Moreno clearly pointing out the implication and the end result of his proposals, I think it's understandably has people concerned. And I think that's where a lot of the bad faith actors latch onto some of this more clear and direct language about transformation. But the area where Moreno and the book is the strongest is at its most general. It's about creating a more balanced neighborhood and creating sufficient local support for commerce, for your neighbor, and being together. I mean, if you look at the tactics throughout the book, it's about how do you convert housing so that you can make sure people have places to live. It's about creating safety around schools through school streets. It's about creating conditions so you can shop local. It's about creating conditions to design for mobility that isn't just cars. It's about being able to redevelop brownfields and remediate them and then convert them into something where people can live, work, play, and have fun. It's about eliminating parking mandates. All of these things individually, I think you hear a lot in urban discourse today. I think the issue is when you start pulling them together, it becomes a lightning rod for people to begin to attack it. I think it's important for us to remember that this is a bundle of a bunch of things synthesized together. I think that's the beauty of the 15-minute city that Carlos Moreno has conceptualized, even if it's something that has already existed and exists today. It's something that we want to make more of. And so I think that's also the tension that I think Addison and I talked about, is that this thing already exists, but it doesn't exist all over. I'm definitely more comfortable talking and supporting a set of policy procedures and aims, which increases our net freedom as that primary goal, not a wholesale change in how we live. The impact far down the road might be a change of how we live, but I think that asking people to change wholesale is problematic. And for me, it's about creating the conditions on the ground where people might have the opportunity to live in a way that they see fit. And so in America, we have a fairly narrow set of land use and zoning rules in which a supermajority of land can only be built single-family detached homes. And those are awesome. I grew up in one. I think they're great. I just think that for the type of people who live in America and the breadth and width of the types of families we have, we can do better. And I think if you stop and peel back some of the flowery language and ignore some of the hyperbole that is mounted against it from some bad faith actors, what you actually see is something fairly conservative. This is a book and a concept which is saying, let's make really great neighborhoods where we can work, we can live, we can meet other people, we can support our neighbor, our small businesses, and each other in a more resilient way. And while I think this is really a small C conservative concept, I think it only looks reactionary to the experiment that we've conducted on our cities for the past 80 years or so. And the policy proposals to make this more proximate and welcoming neighborhood is actually quite slight. And it's not something that would require an overnight change that would disrupt people's lives. It would actually be a little bit more like what Strong Towns talks about, which is more incremental and more change at the pace of people, which I think is something that is both a reality check on this, but also something that could reduce people's fears of the unknown. So everyone should read the book. It's The 15-Minute City. You can check it out at your library. There's a link to it in the show notes. It's an important book. It's an important concept. And I think it is something that we will continue to both debate and to improve. And I'm excited to see where both Carlos Moreno takes it and the larger group of people who believe that creating neighborhoods where we can get around and get stuff done within a short-ish walking distance is the once and future direction of America and elsewhere. We're going to have future episodes where we start to dissect what are the tactics and ways that we could perhaps bring these proximate cities, proximate neighborhoods into action so that we can start to demystify what this means. So stay tuned for future episodes around how do we act on creating the 15-minute neighborhood or proximate neighborhoods. So that's our episode today. As usual, please subscribe to our podcast. You can go to jwp.news. You can find our podcast in any place that you listen to podcasts. We're on Apple, we're on Spotify, You can use your own feed reader. Can you please heart, like, give us a comment, share it with your friends? These non-monetary benefits help us make a better show, help other people listen to it. Just a reminder, all views on this episode are ours only and do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers, or the people we consult for, or really anyone else. We hope you have a great holiday season, and we will see you on the internet. Good day.